Today's Star Trek rewatch episode, In the Pale Moonlight from Deep Space Nine, is sponsored by TrueCar. You know, there's something about TrueCar a lot of people might not know. Using TrueCar can help you buy a used car. In fact, there are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. Whether you're looking to buy a new or used car, you can get upfront pricing information that empowers discounts off the list price for used cars and a better buying experience through the TrueCar certified dealer network. You can see what other people paid for the car that you want, and you'll know what a fair price is, and you can feel confident that you're getting the actual information, unlike the Romulans in this episode. With TrueCar, you can connect with that local certified dealer of your choosing and enjoy a quick and easy car buying experience. With TrueCar, you'll easily find that new or used car that you want, and best of all, TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 off of MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Star Trek Deep Space Nine may be over, but we're just getting started today talking about In the Pale Moonlight. And now, here are the people that hopefully no one will accuse of being fake. I am Rob Sisperi. Here is Jessica Lise. Jessica, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rob. I'm awash in a sea of my own moral ambiguities, but otherwise pretty good.
Good. All right, Jess, I am very excited to, for the first time ever in our many years of podcasting together, we are going to be talking about Star Trek for the first time, and I'm very excited to talk with you about this Deep Space Nine episode that you picked out as one of your favorites and widely viewed as the top Deep Space Nine episode of all time.
Well, yeah, you gotta go big or go home, right? And I figured, you know, nobody else is going to suggest that we talk about Deep Space Nine, so I have to pick the best one right out of the gate.
Okay, well, I want to talk about all of that and your affinity for Deep Space Nine as we go along here today. We are getting ready for Star Trek Discovery, the sixth Star Trek series to come, not to TV, but to CBS All Access. But the premiere is going to be airing on Sunday night. We will have a recap of Star Trek Discovery for you guys, hopefully sometime either Sunday night or Monday morning for you. And if you want to make sure you don't miss any of that, you can subscribe to our Star Trek podcast feed at postyourrecaps.com/Star Trek. And we do appreciate your feedback and your Star Trek ratings in the iTunes store. We appreciate that.
I give that pitch 5 Star Treks.
Thank you. Five Star Treks. I'm not sure what Ferengi rule of acquisition that is to always get 5 stars for your podcast if you can. But that is one of the addendum to the Ferengi rules of acquisition. Jess, I used to have like the paperback book of all of the Ferengi rules of acquisition. I've never told another human being this.
It's okay. I used to have a poster on my wall that had them all written out. It said everything I need to know about life I learned from watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and like half of them were rules of acquisition.
Okay. Jess, is Deep Space Nine your favorite of the Star Trek franchises?
It is indeed my favorite. It's the first one that really, really hooked me.
Okay.
And I've loved Star Trek most of my life, but I was not one of those kids who was like indoctrinated from an early age. I've kind of, you know, came and went on, especially Next Generation, but Deep Space Nine really kind of sunk its claws into me in a way that no other Star Trek series really ever has.
Okay, what was it about Deep Space Nine?
I think the cast of characters on Deep Space Nine were just, like, they just spoke to me. It's a very different show compared to the first 2 Star Trek series that are kind of about going out into the world and adventuring. And in Deep Space Nine, the adventure comes to them at the beginning. And you have this sort of, it's supposed to be an outpost in the middle of nowhere. And you have this captain who's grieving the loss of his wife. And he wants to be assigned to the middle of nowhere so he can kind of lick his wounds. And he's a commander at this point, mm-hmm. and nobody cares about this station. And then all of a sudden this wormhole opens up, and instead of being in this podunk station in the middle of nowhere, kind of settling this planet has been ravaged by war. He's all of a sudden at the epicenter of this whole new world. And then the Federation goes to war. Mm-hmm. And at the point where we're going to be talking about the series, there it's really grim and it's really visceral in a way that I think Star Trek had never gone before. And it's complex. There are gray areas everywhere. There are characters that you should hate, but you love. And there are characters that you should love, but you kind of hate. And I just love it for its complexity. I love it for its long story arcs. I love it for its badass captain. And it's just, it's a fantastic series. It holds up. Even some of the effects don't hold up, but the stories definitely do.
Now, for me, I was always a huge Next Generation fan during the time that it was on. I very vividly remember the premiere of Deep Space Nine, and I remember wanting more from it. I remember being underwhelmed by Deep Space Nine. I know the show eventually did get better, and I stayed with it through most of the time. That the issue for me ended up being once I went off to college, it was tougher to keep up with on a weekly basis, and I ended up sort of like catching up usually during the summer on the reruns, and sometimes I would see it out of order. I think I did try to follow most of the serialized seventh season together. I mean, I did really like it did hook me in once Worf becomes a series regular, and I really liked the point when they first get the Defiant. That was very exciting, and then Sisko ends up getting promoted to captain. So I'm excited to talk with you about this specific episode, The Pale Moon Light.
Yeah, it's really a shame that DS9 is such a slow starter at first. Like, there are some real stinkers of episodes in the first couple of seasons, and you're just like,
yeah.
Even some of the good ones feel sort of like tepid rehashes of Next Gen plots sometimes, but I would say maybe around season four, it really starts to hit its stride.
Well, once they get the Defiant, I feel like that's the point where now they can sort of like go places instead of like, they were always like taking shuttlecraft different places, and shuttlecraft are fine. They're just not that exciting. I was always pretty down on Bajor. I was like, I feel like everything with the stupid hats and going I feel like they spend a lot of time sort of like dealing with like the religious factions of Bajor and stuff like that. That never really interested me as a fan.
Yeah, it was some kind of flimsy world building, I felt like. Although there are some really tour de force performances that came out of that.
Sure, it's because Sisko is viewed as like this important religious figure because of the orbs, right? Is that what they're called?
Yeah, they have these sacred orbs that are scattered throughout the galaxy now, and part of the story of Bajor is kind of reuniting that and kind of finding their identity as
That's going to go to the back burner by the time Deep Space Nine gets really good.
Yeah, like, well, they realized pretty quickly they can't sustain a series on Bajor alone, so let's bring some real bad guys in from across the wormhole, and then it really starts to get cooking because these guys are real, real bad.
Right. And that's when things start to really percolate once we get the Jem'Hadar involved. And they will ultimately form an alliance with the Cardassians. And it will be a full-blown war, which is ultimately very different from anything we could have imagined in the early days of Star Trek or the very friendly and fun Star Trek The Next Generation.
Honestly, for me, one of the great turning points of the series is they spend the first 5.5 seasons in this kind of reluctant alliance with the Cardassians, who had occupied Bajor, and they're just kind of, a lot of them are pretty crappy people, and they still have to find common ground, and you see them making inroads, and you even kind of sympathize with some of the Cardassian characters, and you start to understand like how you can build peace between these factions that had it's a lot of rebuilding. I think they take a lot of, it almost feels like the end of World War II and kind of having to rebuild the trust between nations in Europe is kind of the allegory I felt like. And then you start to see them making inroads. You start to feel sympathy for some of the characters. And then mid-season five, they spin it around. And Gul Dukat takes off in a shuttlecraft and he's like, yeah, I'm with the Dominion now. Cardassia is part of the Dominion. Peace. And it was...
Or war.
Or war. It was kind of mind-blowing. And even though you kind of figure it's coming at some point, and especially if you watch some of the episodes out of order and you're like, wait, I thought they were on the same side. But that moment is just kind of like, well, that makes sense, but still, OMG.
And that ultimately ends up being a really big part of the whole endgame of this series and the whole Dominion War, which dominates the action over the last couple seasons of the show. Jess, so this episode in particular, what is it about In the Pale Moonlight that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I wanted to talk about this. To me, this feels like this episode is really what makes Deep Space Nine so unique in the Star Trek universe. This is a captain who is a very different character from Kirk and a very different character from Picard. And he is in a situation right now that's an impossible situation. And I mean, it's Star Trek, you could say, arguably thrives on captains in impossible situations having to make hard decisions for the greater good. Like, that's kind of what the series is built on. But here, you go to a place that's so dark that you know Picard would not have had anything to do with the situation. And this is really a tour de force for Avery Brooks. He delivers some of his best acting this episode, I feel like. And there's a twist on the end that you think you know where it's going, and it ends up being kind of totally not where it's going. And yet it all makes sense and comes together in the end. And you kind of leave the episode understanding why the decisions were made that were made, but kind of being a little disgusted with everybody anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's different for Star Trek. The people in Star Trek are your heroes. You watch them for their, you know, they watch them to save the world and save humanity and, you know, further understanding. And then you have a character that you've been rooting for all this time, and he does something pretty, pretty awful in this episode.
Right. And this is an interesting point in the history of TV. I believe this episode is from April of 1998, and correct me if I'm wrong on that. Yeah, April 15th, tax day, 1998. And we're now a few years out from the death of Gene Roddenberry, who wanted, I think, a very sort of shiny, happy Star Trek universe. And then in the years after his passing, we end up seeing, especially starting with Deep Space Nine, a little bit more of the darker side of the Star Trek universe. But specifically here, in terms of TV, we're starting to get to the point where we're about a year away from The Sopranos coming on the air and really starting the peak TV and the complicated anti-hero. And this was a bold move for a Star Trek episode to put Sisko in this position where he's dealing with a very morally ambiguous situation.
He is. And I think really all you have to know about the difference between Sisko and Picard is to look back in the mythology of both of the shows and look how Picard handles Q and look how Sisko handles Q. Like, Picard plays mind games. He kind of rolls his eyes at Q, and he, you know, he tries to outwit him. And the second time Q makes an appearance on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Sisko just looks at him and punches him in the face.
Yeah. Garrick is going to get punched in the face in this episode. Yeah, so Sisko...
Sisko's a face puncher.
Yeah, well, certainly more than Picard. Maybe not as many as Kirk.
Not quite as many.
Right. Yeah, that is a good point. I do think, though, I subscribe to the theory that Q did have a thing for Picard.
Oh, he definitely did.
Yeah, but that's another podcast. So, In the Pale Moonlight, if you have not seen this episode or are not familiar with it, just to give you the quick synopsis, what's going on here is that the story is told primarily in flashback, or actually entirely in flashback. Sisko talks about a very complicated time that ultimately he was dealing with, where they were trying to pull the Romulans into an alliance with the Federation and the Klingons. against the Cardassians and the Jem'Hadar. Apparently that the Romulans had signed this sort of non-aggression pact with the Jem'Hadar, which allowed them to move through the neutral zone. And they were sort of like looking the other way as like the Jem'Hadar was hiding in the neutral zone and then staging these attacks. The Jem'Hadar actually takes over Beta Zed in this episode, which is very bad news for Counselor Troi and any relatives that she has back home. And so we end up seeing Sisko enlisting the help of Garak to potentially look for some evidence of a upcoming Jem'Hadar assault on Romulus, which ultimately they're not able to get, and they decide to manufacture some evidence to sell to the Romulans to say, hey, look, oh, looks like the Jem'Hadar is going to attack you guys next. Ultimately, we see that the Romulans do not fall for that plan, but ultimately that we're all pawns in Garak's plan to assassinate the Romulan senator and then draw the Romulans into the war as they believe that the Jem'Hadar has attacked them and killed their senator.
All right, Rob, I'm going to be a super duper nerd here.
Yes. Did I get something wrong?
You did.
What did I say?
I'm going to split some nerdy hairs. And nobody cares about this, but we should get our terminology correct.
The Romulan homeworld, is that what I did wrong?
No.
Okay.
No, you got that one right. Romulus is the Romulan homeworld, funnily enough. The Jem'Hadar are actually one part of the enemy.
The Dominion.
The Dominion.
The Jem'Hadar are the foot soldiers, right?
Yes.
And the Dominion are sort of like, Odo's people.
There's Odo's people, and then there's the Vorta, which we see one of them in this episode. And then there's the Jem'Hadar, who are the like bloodthirsty foot soldiers that are addicted to drugs.
Got it. So, okay, my bad. I mean,
that's all right.
In fairness, it's probably been 20 years since I watched an episode of Deep Space Nine. If not 20 years, then it's been 18 years since I watched an episode of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, it's been a while. I think you're forgiven for not understanding the particulars of the Dominion War, and you probably didn't play as many play-by-email role-playing campaigns as certain other people you might know.
No, I
hadn't. Took place in this universe.
Yes, okay. So you have to forgive me. I'm a little left-handed when it comes to my Deep Space Nine knowledge, especially as like the Next Generation stuff is all still in there. I haven't accessed those files in a long time, but I feel pretty confident about my Next Generation knowledge, whereas Deep Space Nine, you may have to hold my hand a little bit more through this.
Well, that's what I'm here for, Rob. And I've done a full rewatch of both Next Gen and Deep Space Nine semi-recently. It was whenever they hit Netflix.
Okay.
We started watching them. And so it's a little bit more recent for me. I can kind of dredge it up.
So, Jess, one of the interesting things in this episode is we see Captain Sisko end up telling us about what happened using this narrative device of the personal log. There is a lot of journaling that goes on in Starfleet.
It's true. Like, I think they try to give them writing exercises to kind of process their complicated emotions. It's kind of, he's got his bullet journal open and he's kind of working through his day.
And he's been so busy that Captain Sisko doesn't even remember what day it is. He's like getting frustrated. What is the star date? You would think he would have it like on his phone or something or on his pad.
Well, that's why he asks Siri.
Yeah. And so just one of the things that I think is really interesting about this episode is that I feel like that Avery Brooks is breaking the fourth wall for most of this episode. Like, he's talking directly to the camera for most of his personal log.
Yes, he's looking directly into the camera and he's relaying this story. And it's something that I think we don't ever see in Star Trek again, which I think also makes it sort of unique. But I think he does kind of tend to repeat himself a lot. I think they could have cut down this monologuing by about half, and I think it would have been okay.
Yeah.
Because it seems like he goes into this sort of, I have to live with what I've done, and, you know, it was going to get very complicated, and I had to make a decision, and we got it. You had to make that decision, and I don't know. I'm going to have to talk about this to process all my thoughts. Like, yeah, you said that already, too.
Yes. It gets a little like A Few Good Men, where he's like, you know, yeah, that you want the truth. OK, people listening in on this. I did what I had to do. It's also a little bit House of Cards. Like, it's very much that he's breaking the fourth wall. Talking about like, now look, Captain's Log. Let me tell you a little bit about what's happened the last couple of weeks. Just for those of you who weren't paying attention, let me reset everything that's going on in my life.
He's also, it's a bit like Doogie Howser. You got to sit down and like type in his personal journal. Like, today I learned a very valuable lesson.
Yeah. Well, Doogie Howser, that he not only typed it, but then he like talked aloud, right? He would say it.
Yeah.
You didn't have to read it if, you know, you didn't have your glasses on or anything when you were watching Doogie Howser. All right.
So you did have to read it, but sometimes he'd like kind of add something extra to cut back to him, and he'd just like, he'd sigh and then he'd start typing again.
Yes.
But this is basically, this is the Cisco equivalent of that level of journaling.
Yeah. And Doogie Howser was like typing into like MS-DOS.
Yep.
So we see Cisco. He's telling us, oh, it all started when every Friday he used to post the roster of everybody in Starfleet that died and make the entire crew look at all the people that passed away. And every week people would know how many losses the Federation has taken. To the point where Cisco now hates Fridays. Cisco has ruined Fridays. I mean, I guess you could say the Dominion has ruined Fridays, but now they don't even say TGIF anymore on board Deep Space Nine. That's how bad it's gotten.
I'm not sure why he didn't like just hold it through the weekend and post it, or, you know, this is one of those areas where you can tell that like technology now has already surpassed where people in 1998 thought technology would be in 300 years, because I don't know why he doesn't just upload it to everybody's Dropbox.
Right. Or send out some sort of like bulk email. Like, he'd be like, has to put it on the bulletin board in the ready room and everybody can come in and see who they knew.
Yeah. Or you could even just save it to the cloud and you can look at that on your own time in your own way. But no, now he's got to post it on the bulletin board.
Yes. And we hear about Leslie Wong, the tragic passing of Leslie Wong, who was on board the Cairo. Dax knew Leslie Wong. And we see Cisco and Dax talking about the neutral zone and the Dominion and the Romulans, and how the Romulans are not involved in this war. They have this treaty of non-aggression. And just a very dangerous notion is brought up, that the Romulans seem to have a pact of friendship with the Dominion. The Dominion believes in friendship with the Romulans.
Yeah, I think this makes Cisco pissed.
Yes, it's a very comfy treaty that they have. Yeah, but the Romulans, and as Dax points out, they don't seem to mind if that the Dominion is really taking on some of their political rivals in the Federation and the Klingons. Although, for the Romulans, it's a little bit of kicking the can down the road of sort of like appeasement of the Dominion to think that they're not just going to come after the Romulans next. I mean, Cisco does have some fair points.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. Like, you shouldn't necessarily just roll over and turn a blind eye to what's going on here, because they're going to come for everybody and then you're going to be left, and they have no guarantee of that. But they also really hate the Klingons and they really aren't fans of the Federation either. So
there's a lot of bad blood.
I kind of see it. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of bad blood. There's a long and storied history of Romulan conflict.
Right. We're at like 14 TV seasons of bad blood with the Romulans already at this point.
It's true. And they're like the Vulcans, but much angrier.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. So Cisco is going to try to role play with Dax of what Cisco could say to the Romulans to try to get them to draw them into the war. So Cisco decided at that moment that he was going to try to bring the Romulans into the war. I thought that Dax actually does a really good job of role-playing a Romulan here.
Well, Dax was always my favorite.
Yes.
And I think she really, she has many, many centuries of experience to draw from. And many, she's been around for all 14 of those seasons of Romulan conflict.
Yeah. So. Do you like when Cisco calls Dax old man?
I do. It's cute. He does it every episode, so it's less cute because of that. But yeah, I get it. I get it. You guys were friends in her previous life. Okay.
Yeah. Did you like when they got the new Dax?
I loved new Dax. This is an unpopular opinion.
Well, but yes. Hot take alert.
Hot take alert.
Hold on. Let me sound the hot take alert. Now, is this hot take alert yellow or hot take alert red?
Given how much hate there was for new Dax when she came out, I think it's probably hot take alert red.
Go to red alert.
And I think like Jadzia Dax was kind of a very beloved character in the Star Trek Deep Space Nine universe. And she got kind of unceremoniously killed off in part because Terry Farrell apparently didn't get along with the rest of the cast.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Went off to do a sitcom with Ted Danson.
Yeah, she went to go be on Decker, right? Becker.
Which really, I watched Becker because I was very loyal to Deep Space Nine at the time. And I watched Becker. That's a downgrade.
yeah.
But they bring on Nicole DeBoer, she's a very talented actor. She went on to star in The Dead Zone and was great in that too.
Yes.
And she brought a really different angle to Dax.
Yes.
While still kind of retaining some of the core, which you need to when you're a Trill. But the premise that she kind of got thrust into this situation that she did not plan for and now had to cope with something more complicated than she'd anticipated. This is kind of a great echo of where Sisko was at the start of the series.
Yeah.
And I thought for that alone, it was interesting. But I think she brought a lot of new information to the character. Didn't love where she ended up romantically at the end, but I thought she was interesting and she brought something new to the character.
So we see Dax and Sisko feel like that they ultimately have in this role play, they come to the conclusion that they need evidence. So Sisko goes to go talk to Garrick, the tailor. And I do find that Garrick is probably not a good tailor, right, Jess?
I mean, look at the clothes he's selling. There are all these unfinished seams everywhere.
Do you see anybody ever wearing a Garrick garment?
Sometimes you see people trying them on to be nice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or they come in and they have to pretend they like something so that people won't know they're doing spy stuff.
Right. So really, that we could say this, that the Garrick being a tailor, it's all a front, right?
Yeah, as a tailor, you know, he's a very good spy.
And so they want to talk about this mission to go to Cardassia Prime and get this evidence from the Cardassia Prime headquarters. But they just decide that they need to go get this evidence. I mean, are we to believe that this evidence actually exists? Like, I didn't feel like that Sisko had any reason to believe there were secret plans for the Dominion to invade Romulus that were going to be held on Cardassia. Did you feel like that was sort of like a leap in logic?
Well, no, I think it was more like the first step to getting the evidence is to see if there is any. I'm not sure he necessarily thought there was, but it would be kind of stupid if he went to all the trouble to like fabricate something if there really was some dirt on somebody that he could have used. And Garrick's got those connections, so why not?
I guess so, but it seemed like that there was going to be a lot of life that was going to be placed into harm's way to ultimately make this determination to find this evidence.
Yeah, it seems like a bit of a leap, especially since, you know, the Dominion's not like immediately letting Cardassia in on all their super secret plans.
Garrick is going to need to call in every single favor that he does. But Garrick ultimately is going to get pretty invested in this plan. Why do you feel like that is, Jess?
Well, there's two things. Thing number one, he's a shitty tailor and he's really bored.
He's very bored. Yeah.
And thing number two, he's basically been rejected by his entire home planet, and he's got kind of an axe to grind against Cardassia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you see over and over throughout the series, Garrick is invested in getting whatever kind of large and small revenge he can on the people that have thrown him off of his planet and reduced him to running this two-bit clothing boutique on this outpost in the middle of nowhere.
Right. So ultimately, it seems like that Garak is pushing for this plan even harder than Sisko at this point.
He sees the opportunity to do something exciting that also maybe hurts the Dominion, and he's on board with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of things I think over and over, you don't know everything about Garak. You go through the whole series, you don't know everything. Sometimes they reveal a tantalizing little piece, but there's a lot of his motivations that always seem kind of murky, and you never really get a clear picture of what he wants and everything he's done in his past. And so I think we're not meant to know exactly why he's super into this, but super into it he is.
He's really into it. He's very much into this plan. So Sisko ends up then back in flashback telling us about how he committed himself because his cause was righteous. His intentions were good. And Avery Brooks really does go to 11 on all of these monologues that he has in this episode. To me, it's very much like a one-man show that Avery Brooks delivers in doing the whole personalogue.
Yeah, it really does seem like the sort of thing that, you know, it's like Bryan Cranston doing LBJ.
Yeah, very much so. So Sisko knows bad news always comes at night, and then he's sleeping. I don't know why Sisko sleeps with all the lights on in his quarters, but my son does that, so I guess it's not that weird.
Well, maybe he's scared of the dark.
That's possible.
Guy some slack. Maybe he has one of those, like, eye mask things.
Scary times. Well, he was not wearing an eye mask.
That you know of. He could have taken it off.
I guess so. He had a premonition before the bad news came, and they need him to get to Ops because the Dominion has invaded Beta Zed. Unfortunately, none of the Betazoids were able to see this attack looming.
They felt it coming.
They felt
they
it coming,
do about it.
But they weren't able to do anything.
I sense the Dominion is coming to attack us. Yeah. I sense anger. I sense aggression.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so now the Dominion has taken Beta Zed, and now they are in prime position to move into Vulcan from here.
Yeah, that puts them within shooting distance of Vulcan.
Yeah, things are getting serious.
Yeah, it's getting real.
Garak ends up telling Sisko all of his operatives were murdered, but Garak is not giving up. Now, knowing how this episode ends, do you buy that all of Garak's operatives were murdered, or is he just telling Sisko that to move to the plan that he actually wants to do?
Do we even know that Garak went to Cardassia? Let's be real.
So everybody that he talked to allegedly was murdered within 24 hours. And so he has a different plan. Should we falsify the evidence?
Right. And we get somebody, we need to find somebody who's really, really good at that sort of thing. Like they can do a little green screening here and there.
Or blue screening. That's, even.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe everything looks blue to that guy.
Yeah.
They got this guy, Graython Tolar, who is he is apparently very, very good at faking stuff. He does some, you know, digital effects in his spare time, and he's not a very good guy, but we could bust him out of whatever Klingon prison he's in and bring him to the station.
Yeah. Do we know what he's in for?
We don't, but it could be, as we find out later, he could be really... Any number of things could have pissed off the Klingons.
Yeah, he's an unsavory character, and he has some sort of like a deviant appetite for. It seems like that he is trying to, you know, harass the Dabo girls at Quark's later on in this episode. So, not a great guy, Graython Tolar. But what they are going to do is that there is a Romulan senator that has negotiated this peace treaty, this non-aggression pact with the Dominion, Senator Vrenak. If we can get him to come to Deep Space Nine, we might be able to feed him this bill of goods, which he can take back to the Romulan Senate.
He's so invested in this non-aggression pact that it's kind of like you get him on board with it, he's definitely going to convince other people because he was somebody that... He would have done a 180. He'd have to have a really good reason. So it's a solid plan.
Okay. And that they're going to put it on some sort of a rod. And then this rod is going to prove. I don't know necessarily. I wasn't following why this particular rod. I couldn't really wrap my head around the recording technology.
Yeah, I always wonder about this. And again, this is one of those cases of technology now better than technology they thought was going to be good 300 years from now, right. 20 years ago.
Right.
Because this looks like a test tube filled with colored liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems kind of fragile to me. Like, you know, somebody's going to drop that and it's going to shatter and then you don't have any data.
Right.
So I think it's one of those things like right now, apparently you can, they're doing experiments where you can code information onto a strand of DNA. Maybe this is sort of what we're looking at here.
Okay. Perhaps. Okay.
Perhaps.
All right. So they need to get Graython Tolar out of the Klingon prison. And so ultimately they're going to do that. And he is going to soon be at Deep Space Nine. And he is talking with Sisko about the plan. And he is negotiating, and Sisko is like constantly in this episode having to continue to give more and more to unsavory characters in this episode. Graython Tolar is asking for a number of Orion girls, Orion slave girls.
Ew.
Yeah.
Those are the green ones that Kirk likes.
Right. You would think that the Federation would have done more in the 100 years since the original series to cut down the human trafficking of Orion slave girls.
Well, there is that. But I guess one battle at a time. And they got some bigger fish to fry right now.
Right. Is Orion a planet in the Federation?
I don't recall, to be honest. Like, that's more of an original series thing.
Yes. But Orion slave girls are still a thing at the time of Deep Space Nine.
I guess.
Okay. Who are they slaves to?
Maybe they're not slaves anymore. Maybe they're just independent contractors. Did anybody say slave in the episode?
I thought he said Orion slave girls. He wants, like, five Orion slave girls.
Maybe it's just an expression. Maybe it's idiomatic.
Okay. All right.
Maybe
we'll
it's like a consensual... It's a consensual relationship, but I guess if he's trading for them, but in any event, nobody actually intends to give him any of that stuff.
So. Right, right. And maybe Star Trek Discovery will delve into this more and we'll get some answers.
Yeah, it's more like, how about we free you and we don't beat you up?
That's right. That's right. What do you think of that deal? Okay. So ultimately, this guy seems to be very concerned about Garak. He feels like Garak is a very menacing figure.
Yeah. Well, Garak is super sketchy. I think that's something that the show teaches us over and over. Graython Tolar is clearly correct to be suspicious of Garak.
And Sisko knew at this point he had made a mistake, but he doubly knew when Odo calls him up to tell him that Graython Tolar tried to kill Quark.
That's not the first person that's tried to kill Quark. Probably not even that week.
No. And I was psyched to see Quark. I love the Ferengi.
Yeah, I mean, the one downside this episode is that you spend so much time on Sisko, you see almost nobody else. It's Sisko and Garak. It's really their episode. And so this little interlude with Quark feels a little shoehorned in, but I'm happy to see Quark in.
Right.
At any rate.
Ultimately, that there was an altercation at Quark's, and Graython Tolar ultimately stabbed Quark over this altercation that he was getting very drunk. He ultimately was trying to harass some of the women there, and he stabs Quark, and then ultimately gets a lot of blood on Quark's clothes. Sisko does not want there to be any record that Graython Tolar is there, so he has to tell Odo, okay, don't file a report. He has to tell Quark, okay, let's just keep this between us, and then has to, again, make some other dicey deals with Quark.
I love how delighted Quark is when he realizes he's being bribed.
Yes, and he even cites the 98th Ferengi rule of acquisition, which is every man has a price, which I believe is the DiBiase rule.
Sounds like it. I think next step is we got to give Quark a diamond-studded suit.
The Garak of the Ferengi homeworld has already been working on that.
That's going to cost a lot of latinum.
So, again, Sisko is continually saying, am I making a mistake? Like, really is second-guessing his decisions along the way. But at that very moment where he's doubting himself, a new casualty list comes around. Again, nobody's saying TGIF on Deep Space Nine.
No, it's like a whole week of bad decisions. And then he's just reminded it's for the greater good. Mm-hmm. But I think anytime you find yourself in a position where you have to bribe Quark, you got to really take a hard look at what you're doing.
Okay. So, Jess, that the situation becomes even dicier as Garak comes back and says, okay, there's a new complication involving biomimetic gel, one of the other things that are always talked about on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, that's the MacGuffin gel.
Yeah.
They never really say what it does.
Yeah.
Just that it's real, real bad.
Yes. Who needed this gel?
It was the guy that had the data rod.
Okay. Oh, that's they needed to get the rod. They needed to trade for 200 liters of the biomimetic gel. They're ultimately going to get it down to 85 liters of biomimetic gel. Dr. Bashir is really clutching his pearls during this whole situation with Sisko and be like, I'm going to be filing an official objection to doing this.
You know, Dr. Bashir got a lot easier to deal with over time, but man, having him in there, like being all self-righteous about it, kind of has the same effect as posting the casualty list. It puts you a little bit more in Sisko's corner.
I believe that this scene was actually used as his audition for Doran Martell on Game of Thrones, Jess.
Yeah, they're both.
I object. We shouldn't do anything.
Pretty much. He's definitely playing to type there.
Like, okay, Alexander, could you sit down for this next one? We want to get see what this would be like if you were sitting delivering those lines. Jess, we go and check out what Graythan Toler has created for this holographic recreation.
Yeah, he's Dark Helmet playing with the action figures.
Right. And they add in some roasting of Gul Dukat. And they feel like that really helps sell it.
Yeah, definitely they're going to talk smack about Gul Dukat. and, you know, they're going to argue with each other. And some of it does feel a little bit forced.
Yes.
But it's probably better than whatever it was when they started. Because I'm imagining, like, the first draft was something like, hey, I hope nobody finds out about our super secret plans to invade Romulus.
So they were able to add a little more banter, and they had like somebody come in and punch up the dialogue. And then they got it close enough where they feel like, okay, it's good, I guess. But Sisko is really, he really pounds his fist on the table of like, they better not think that this is a fake.
Right. We're going to give you back to Gowron if you mess this up. So I guess.
Right.
He's going to do his best.
Jess, we start to get the Romulan shuttlecraft arriving on Deep Space Nine. Even the Romulan shuttlecraft has a cloaking device that we see a cloaked Romulan shuttle dock at Deep Space Nine.
Well, sure, because they don't want anybody to know that he's there.
That's right.
It's a super secret meeting.
It's a very secret
meeting. He's violating the pact already. Like, even Vrenak is getting called in to do things that he didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Vrenak is there, and they give him some Romulan ale there, Jess. Is it Romulan ale, or it's a different? It's a Romulan, a different alcoholic beverage.
Do the Romulans drink anything that's not bright blue?
I don't know. They love blue stuff. And I mean, the Romulans, they drink so much Romulan ale, but do we ever see Romulans like really wasted?
Well, this goes back to a piece of like strange Star Trek canon, which is that if you replicate something, like replicated alcohol doesn't get you drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's synthahol. And
yes.
I think the point they're making while they're talking about, oh, this is pretty good blue stuff for something you replicated, means it doesn't have any kick to it. They're not going to get drunk.
Mm-hmm. But even the real Romulan ale that I could see Klingon ale. I could see the Klingons like getting very drunk and rowdy. But I don't really ever recall seeing rowdy Romulans.
Yeah, well, they don't like to get drunk around outsiders, but they have their own parties. They don't really invite anybody else.
So over some blue stuff, Sisko is trying to make the case about how, hey, we could work together.
Right. And do you recognize Vrenak, Rob?
I don't. The actor is Stephen McHattie. What do you recognize Stephen McHattie from?
Well, most recently he did several episodes of Orphan Black, which was a show that I used to cover for post-show recaps.
Mm-hmm.
But He is actually on another show that you podcast about. You are currently podcasting about.
Oh, that I'm currently podcasting about. Okay, because I have looking at his IMDb, and I see that he was on The Strain at one point. I was hoping that you weren't going to conjure up memories of The Strain.
I understand that's not desirable around post-show recaps.
No, no. So what show is he in?
He was in 4 episodes of Seinfeld.
Yes. Oh, what did he play?
He was Elaine Svengali.
Okay. Oh, he played Elaine's therapist.
Yes.
No, I did not recognize him, and I could not have picked him out of a lineup, but there is Senator Vrenak.
I recognized his voice from Orphan Black, but I would not have been able to pick him out of a lineup either.
Sisko is trying to sell what's going on there, and he says, okay, oh, well, maybe we have some evidence. And, of course, Vrenak wants to see it. Jess, I was watching this holographic replication that Graython Toller put together, and I felt like that there seems like I felt like that maybe there's some fake dialogue that is in here. Listen to what the Cardassians are planning in this holographic replication. You tell me what you think.
And with the Cardassian Fourth Order protecting their flank, the 23rd Jem'Hadar Division will begin its thrust across the Glentaurus sector.
I'm sorry, the thrust across what sector?
Thrust across the Glentaurus sector.
Oh, man. Graython Toller is 12, isn't he? He's a 12-year-old boy.
Oh, really? They managed to find out that this was fake? That the invasion is going to be thrust across the Glentaurus sector?
And with the Cardassian Fourth Order protecting their flank, the 23rd Jem'Hadar Division will begin its thrust across the Glentaurus sector.
Yes, okay.
Right across the flank.
Right. And the often cloaked Glentaurus sector.
I mean, good on them for finding it, I guess.
Yes. Many a man went out looking for it and never came back. So, can't believe the Romulans figured this out.
Yeah, a bunch of brain trust over there on Romulus. But there's a really tense moment here where you think for a second it might actually work. And like, maybe this is what Sisko's talking about this whole episode, about how he's compromised himself and he's made these hard choices. And he thinks he might have made a mistake, but it looks like for a second he's going to buy it.
Right. Sisko talks about how his father taught him something as a chef. There's lots of talk about his dad, the chef, in Deep Space Nine, and that you all you can do sometimes with a casserole is just wait. It's either going to rise or it's not. And so there was nothing that he could do to accelerate the process here, Jess.
Yeah, he just had to wait and see if it worked.
Yes.
And then, of course, like, some of the best acting of the whole episode, we find out whether or not it works.
Yes. So Sisko goes to go check in with Vrenak and find out what he thought about this rod. And after further review, the decision comes back.
It's a fake.
Oh, no.
I love that. I want that to be my text message alert.
It's a fake.
It's a trap of the Star Trek universe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great delivery.
It's a fake.
And that's an act break. They go out on that. I don't know if that would be what you would say if you found out that that's not right. It's like, this is weird. This doesn't seem right to me. And there is no Glentaurus sector.
That you know of.
I've heard the Glentaurus sector is a myth. That's right.
It's a fake.
All right. It all blew up in Sisko's face. And now, I mean, Vrenak just leaves in a huff. I do think that this could have been a lot worse.
I think he just really wants to get out of there and be like, hey, look what the Federation tried to do. How about we go join the Dominion?
Mm-hmm.
And again, in 2017... if someone's presenting fake news to you to try to get you to join a war,
mm-hmm.
you're going to leave the room, you're going to hop on the internet, and you're going to email everyone, you're going to send the copies of the data rod. You're going to upload the data rod to emails. The cloud.
You can't use your email for this type of stuff, Jess.
Well, it depends on which server you use, apparently. But you're going to like get on Facebook and like put all your Romulan buddies on blast. Hey, look what the Federation tried to do. And he's not even going to get back.
Well, maybe he was afraid of getting on some sort of like subspace intercept. So he wanted to deliver. You deliver bad news in person. You don't want to like text this news back to the Romulan Senate.
Yeah, or risk having it wind up on WikiLeaks or something like that.
That's right. And so, now Sisko is just waiting. And that, basically, they're going to tell the Federation Sisko is going to look really bad, and Vrenak just wants to expose the vile deception. But guess what, Jess? Senator Vrenak's shuttle exploded, Sisko finds out.
Dun, dun, dun.
And they believe that the Dominion was responsible. And this almost ends up being similar to the events leading up to World War One. The assassination of Senator Vrenak ends up pulling the Romulan Empire into this war.
Yeah, it's also like the Pearl Harbor of Romulus.
Yes, but nobody really seems to do a thorough investigation about this incident. No, the Romulan authorities are not coming in.
It's a fake.
They're sort of just taking it all on face value.
Right. Well, they didn't know that he went to Deep Space Nine at all. There's no record of it. He was cloaked the whole time. Nobody saw him.
Mm-hmm.
And he apparently was already well back on the path that he would have been taking if he hadn't made the detour.
Mm-hmm. But immediately, Sisko figures it all out and goes down to Garak and just starts punching him in the face.
Typical Sisko.
Classic Sisko. Punch in the face first, ask questions later.
Yep, exactly.
Yes. And so we find out that Garak knew all along that this idiot, Graython Toler, was worthless and was never going to be able to trick the Romulans.
Right. Well, you know, he's a blue guy with no mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What happened to Graython Toler? Did he end up getting whacked?
Yeah, he did. I believe Garak whacked him.
Yes. How?
There's a point where the last time we see Graython Toler, he leaves, and on his way out, Garak looks at him and says, "Hey, I'll stop by and say hi later." Mm-hmm. And you see this little look of terror come across his little blue face. And that's basically, Garak paid him a visit later and dispatched him.
What did he do with his body?
I don't know. Shady shit happens all the time on Deep Space Nine. I'm sure Garak has his channels.
Out the airlock?
Garak's got his own, like, Winston Wolfe to take care of this kind of stuff.
Right. Because, I mean, Garak admits here with Sisko that both Graython Toler and Senator Vrenak were tragic victims of the war.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we find out that the Romulans will indeed now enter the war, that they are working with the Federation and the Klingons against the Dominion and Cardassian alliance.
Yeah, so everything worked. They got the evidence they needed. They, in a matter of speaking, they did manufacture the evidence they needed to get the Romulans into the war.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess the whole point of the episode, at what price?
At what price? And so Sisko ultimately is, you know, they feel like that perhaps this effort saved the Alpha Quadrant. But Sisko is still conflicted about this, that he talks about in his journal about how this was a huge victory for the good guys. And he lied, he cheated, he bribed a man, but he has to live with it. There's nothing else that he can do.
I got a question. The welcome to the fight party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was weird that they would have a welcome to the fight party. Were the Romulans actually going to this party?
I don't think they were. I don't think there were any Romulans nearby. Like, they're just celebrating amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they were drinking Romulan ale. Like, they had like a special at Quark's of like Romulan ale half off for the welcome to the fight party.
Yeah, but is it the real stuff or is it replicated?
Replicated.
Yeah, that's not much of a party.
Okay. Well, look, it's just all marketing for Quark. Quarketing.
Yeah, I think we found our hashtag.
Yes, that's one of the Ferengi rules of acquisition of, any way you can get a drink special, do it.
All right. Fair enough.
At Quark's. Yes. And so Sisko tells us Garak was right about one thing. A guilty conscience is a small price to pay. Sisko will learn to live with it. He can live with it. And then he erases the entire personal log and the screen goes to black, Jess.
Yeah, that was a little on the nose.
Little on the nose. Yeah, turn it off. So ultimately, I mean, do you feel like that Sisko is being a baby here? I mean, I kind of feel like that ultimately what happened ends up being, I feel like, less morally ambiguous for him. I mean, he does have to end up living with this lie, but the way it ends up playing out, it ends up being less of a lie on him. He did sort of invite that senator to Deep Space Nine, but he didn't do it under the pretext that the senator was going to be assassinated. And he didn't know about the death of Graythan Tolar ahead of time. I kind of feel like that Sisko, for the most part, his hands are clean on this.
Well, he's the one that kind of brought all these people to their deaths. He didn't pull the trigger, but he feels responsible. And especially since Garak's the kind of guy that's not necessarily going to lose any sleep over it.
But at the present time, you know, the Dominion is invading all these planets and taking over all of these, you know, Federation allies. It's only a matter of time before they get to Vulcan. Eventually, Earth, you would think, is going to be one of the targets. So I do feel like that for the greater good, a small sacrifice was made. I don't think Captain Sisko needs to lose much sleep over this.
He can kind of console himself with the fact he's the only one who has to. And I think that's simultaneously very hard and very easy because, you know, he has to have all of this on his shoulders. But to everyone else, it looks like what it, you know, on from the outside, it looks like, you know, the Dominion killed this guy and now the Romulans are joining us. And that's a lucky break for us. And they don't really know what went into that luck happening. And Sisko's the only one that has to live with it. Everyone else can kind of believe that this was all very above board.
Is the problem that he has to live with it or that he doesn't have anybody to talk about this with? Like, this is like a good story and he can't tell anybody except the personal log and then he has to delete it.
Yeah, he can only blog about it and like post it in a private entry.
Yeah. Jess, do you have any information about how this episode was received by Deep Space Nine fans in 1998?
I think it really blew everybody away. Like, it's got a great reception right off the bat. And it has endured. I mean, this routinely makes people's top 10 lists of Deep Space Nine episodes. And I think straight out, people were really, this really took the series to a new level. And I have some mixed feelings about season 7 on the whole, but the way that the war arc was resolved, I think if you skip every episode where they go into the Holo Suite with the 1960s nightclub, you end up with a really satisfying end to a very complicated story.
What were your issues with the season 7 storyline?
Mostly, I hated that they took the Holo Suite and they just installed a lounge singer in it 24/7. And every time they felt like the war was getting too heavy, they're just going to go and like play Ocean's 11 for a while.
Yes. Yes. All right.
And
well,
James Darren is okay, but not for, you know, every single episode.
So there's a lot there for anybody that wants to go back and do a rewatch of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, I hope you like Frank Sinatra because
yes,
they really hammer home Rat Pack references. It's like all day, every day in season 7. And it's the thing that always amuses me is like, why do people in the 24th century care so much about the 20th century?
They're really obsessed with it. Yeah,
they really are. And to kind of an unhealthy degree, you've got all of history. Like, I have to imagine there's some cool stuff that happened in the 22nd century.
Maybe not. Maybe people were busy with all this space exploration. Maybe it's sort of that the American arts, or I'm sorry, the earthly arts ends up taking a back seat to, ooh, what's going on Vulcan? What's going on all these other places? You know, World War III is going to happen.
That's true. And you got the Bell Riots, which was a big historical turning point of the 2030s. And I don't know, there was one point, like, I think that's how, isn't that how Enterprise ended, where it turns out that like Riker's flashing back to the Enterprise years in the Holosuite?
I'm not sure.
It's been a while. I didn't get all the way to Enterprise.
It's been a minute. Yeah, but yeah. Certainly Voyager, I'm definitely foggy on. Enterprise, I am the most foggy on.
Well, Voyager doubled down on the 20th century crap, too.
Yeah. Jess, we are getting ready for Star Trek Discovery to launch. Do you feel like that the themes touched on in Pale Moonlight are going to be visited heavily in Discovery?
Well, the thing that I have heard about Discovery, and I think they seem to have been very cagey about what exactly the show is going to be about. We kind of have a rough estimate of what the time period is, and we know a little bit about the characters, but the overarching sense that I get of what this series is going to be is that it is going to be much darker and it is going to deal with these sorts of complex moral quandaries. So I think this really sets the tone for what we can expect out of Discovery. And if they use this as the blueprint, I think we're going to be in for a very good show.
What is your hype level for Star Trek Discovery?
Well, you know, you should have asked me this a year ago, because a year ago it was at like 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I was poised to write recaps of it, which has now kind of fallen through as the site that I write for has ended their written coverage in the interim. But they just kept pushing it forward and pushing it forward. And at this point, I'm kind of having to muster my hype.
Yeah.
I will be watching it, of course, because it says Star Trek on it. And
but just because it got pushed back, that's why you're sort of down on it?
I'm a little down on it. It makes me wonder. I'm a little concerned at how much, you know, they've had to rework, and it seems like maybe they don't have their act quite together. Maybe there isn't a clear vision for it, which might account for why it just keeps getting postponed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm going to watch it. I'm going to try to muster some cautious optimism going in, and it's got a really great cast. I mean, who doesn't love Snequa Martin Green? She was one of the, she's one of the stars in the firmament of The Walking Dead, and I really miss her on that program. So I think they have all the raw materials there. Let's see if they can bring it together.
Yeah. And in fairness, you know, the first season of most Star Trek is bad. So, you know.
That is a very fair point.
Just got to get through it. We just got to get through it. No, I am actually pretty excited to see what is going to be going on. This Sunday night, I believe the premiere is going to be airing on CBS. We will have our recap of that, which you can check out when you subscribe to the podcast. Go to postshowrecaps.com/Star Trek. And Jess and I will be talking on Sunday as well when we pick up the third season of Fear the Walking Dead, speaking of The Walking Dead. And we'll be talking about everything going on the ranch down in Tijuana and the dam and all of the moral ambiguity which goes on in the Fear of the Walking Dead universe.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's a better season than some of the previous seasons.
That's right. That's right. Okay. All right. Well, you can follow Jess on Twitter. She is at Haymaker Hattie, just like the ones that Captain Sisko throws around left and right. I am at Rob Pistorino. Jess, you want to go with the hashtag Quarketing?
You're not going to get a better hashtag than that about anything all week.
That's pretty good. All right, Jess, anything else before we sign off?
No, this was really fun. I've never gotten to podcast about Star Trek before. And
it's new to me as well.
I think there's not a show that I've ever been more nuts about. So
okay.
I'm very excited to have done this.
All right, well, I hope that we can talk some Star Trek Discovery along the way as well this season. So I'm looking forward to that. And then I will talk to you on Sunday for Fear the Walking Dead. Have a good one, everybody. Take care. Bye.